Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thanks so much. Thanks for inviting me, Samantha. It's great to see you. It's great to be in Paris, although it's also 1 o'clock in the morning in California, so apologies for any infelicities that may cause. So in recent years, states and private corporations, as we've heard, have turned their attention to these reserves of cobalt and nickel and rare earth minerals and asteroids, ice water on the moon, and other kinds of extractable celestial resources. So what, if anything, justifies property and political authority over celestial resources? Can space companies or nation states claim property rights in these resources? What kind of political authority should determine whether and how much extraction of celestial resources should be allowed? And who should participate in making the rules on that topic? So I am not an international lawyer, especially not a space lawyer. And as we'll hear from the law papers, existing treaty-based outer space law does provide some basis for thinking about these questions. But since I'm a political theorist, political philosopher, in keeping with my kind of disciplinary background, my main orientation in the paper is not legal, but rather normative and philosophical. So what would a normatively justified regime for the appropriation and governance of celestial resources look like? Now, since outer space is not a place that people currently inhabit, although as Professor Hoeb just noted, that may come to pass, but right now, outer space is not an inhabited place. And since nation states and private corporations mainly seek to appropriate celestial resources in order to gain property in them, I start in the paper from the thought that the best guide to a justified governance regime over celestial resources might begin from theories of property and draw on the resources of philosophy of property. So what I do, my paper sort of is structured in the following way. I start out by considering what regime of property rights over celestial resources is most normatively justified. And then I think about whether there are additional governance criteria beyond property that bear on the legislation of rules about celestial resources. And then I ask what kind of institutional design will be most effective at satisfying the governance criteria while also approximating a justified property regime. And from that perspective, I actually conclude that the 1979 Moon Agreement, to me anyway, looks pretty normatively attractive. The problem is that the Moon Agreement has not been ratified by very many states, and especially not by spacefaring powers. So I conclude the paper by asking, well, what kind of second best alternative frameworks might be worthy of our support, given that the Moon Agreement framework looks likely to be infeasible? So other participants in the conference know a lot more than I do about outer space law, and their papers are centrally concerned with it, so I'm not going to spend too much time reviewing the current outer space law framework. I'm just going to mention a few key points that sort of set the background for contemporary controversies. So we've already seen Samantha put up, to start with, Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which very clearly states that the moon and other celestial bodies is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, by means of use and occupation, or by any other means. And this treaty, as we saw as well, also states that the exploration and use of outer space should be carried on for the benefit and in the interests of all countries and shall be the province of all mankind. But the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, I think in the opinion of many, did not answer all the questions we might have regarding the use and exploitation of celestial resources. It's not clear from the text of the treaty whether extractable resources in outer space can be unilaterally appropriated, especially given the language that outer space should be free for exploration and use by all states. So does the prohibition of appropriation extend only to claiming sovereignty over celestial bodies, or does it also extend to the extraction of celestial resources? And might we think that use could encompass commercial exploitation of outer space resources? To my non-legally trained mind, the Outer Space Treaty leaves the disposition of those questions open. Now, the 1979 Moon Agreement attempted to resolve a lot of these difficulties. It declared that the moon and its natural resources, as well as the resources of other celestial bodies, are the common heritage of mankind, and that neither the surface nor the subsurface of the moon shall become the property of any state, any intergovernmental organization, corporation, or persons. Instead, the exploitation of celestial resources were to be governed by a future sort of to-be-constructed international regime whose purposes were to include the equitable sharing by states and the benefits of those resources, whereby the interests and needs of developing countries would be given special consideration alongside the efforts of spacefaring countries. So the Moon Agreement goes clearly beyond the Outer Space Treaty by prohibiting the unilateral appropriation of property in exploitable resources by states or private firms. Instead, under a common heritage regime, celestial resources would be subject to international administration, which could decide whether to prohibit or permit some limited exploitation, and which would have to balance the benefits of exploitation against a mandate to preserve the area, outer space, for future generations, including by limiting environmental abuse. And firms and governments that were permitted to exploit celestial resources would be obliged to share their bounty with other countries, with special regard to the developing world. But as I said, the Moon Agreement has proved controversial. It's not been endorsed by spacefaring nations. As of now, only 18 countries have ratified the agreement, and none of them are space powers. So given the weak global subscription to the Moon Treaty, countries like the US and Luxembourg, the UAE, Japan, have exploited the kind of existing ambiguities of the more widely supported Outer Space Treaty to pass national level legislation that would allow private countries to mine and private companies to mine and own resources from the moon and asteroids. And then more recently, as we've heard, the US has also promoted the Artemis Accords starting in 2020, a non-binding soft law agreement that's now signed by 56 countries that explicitly affirms that the extraction of space resources does not constitute national appropriation under Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty. So the accords also contain no requirement to share profits from extraction or to regulate extraction by any kind of central international body. So I'm going to use this current controversy over the Moon Agreement on the one hand and the Artemis Accords on the other as a kind of jumping off point to ask the following questions. What considerations ought to inform a justified regime for the appropriation and exploitation of celestial resources? What would a justified celestial property regime look like? Now, some people might get off the boat already by questioning whether the extraction of resources in outer space can be ruled out already ex ante on environmental grounds. And there are indeed, I think, quite significant environmental concerns about space mining. Getting rockets into space and back is very energy intensive, and it may be polluting. Mining asteroids could create space debris that could be difficult to dispose of, and there may be other as yet unknown environmental concerns. But the environmental question may not be so easily resolvable because there are also some environmental considerations in favor of space mining. Decarbonization and the clean energy transition here on Earth require vast supplies of rare earth minerals. Those minerals are found in abundance on asteroids. And some have argued that space mining has the potential to reduce a lot of the negative environmental externalities involved with mining here on Earth, because it's conducted very far away from human habitats and delicate ecosystems. So it's not entirely obvious to me how we should balance those competing concerns. But I'm gonna, for the purposes of my talk here, I'm gonna proceed on the assumption that some limited and regulated space mining may be permissible. And what I wanna do is to think about some considerations that have traditionally been thought to justify property rights and to ask how they might bear on the question of appropriation and exploitation of celestial resources. So let's start with the idea of first come, first serve. The U.S., other spacefaring nations, advocate pretty much a regime where celestial resources are appropriated by whatever firm or state can get to them first and is able to exploit the resources. Now, that kind of a rule obviously benefits the more technologically advanced countries who can appropriate the most valuable resource stocks. But why should being first have any normative significance at all? So it's true that classical natural law thinkers, Grotius and Pufendorf, they did invoke principles of first occupancy in their theories to justify appropriation of property. But they also raised a lot of questions about the first occupancy principle. So Pufendorf in particular asks, how could a what he calls a bare corporal act, like seizure, exclude the rights of other users of the common, unless they agreed to it? And so both Pufendorf and Grotius actually appeal to a primordial agreement or convention among humanity in favor of the first occupancy principle as a rule for creating exclusive property and resources. And that primordial agreement works to counteract worries about unilaterally imposing onerous exclusionary duties on other people by procuring their consent to those duties. But we actually don't have any kind of global agreement on first come, first serve. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty does not commit to that principle. So absent that kind of background convention, I think there is no reason to assume that getting there first has normative significance. Okay, second, let's think about the idea of taking pains. So going all the way back to Locke, some have argued that people who labor on things, who improve them, who are entitled to keep the things that they've labored on in recompense for their efforts. Now, this is a kind of desert-based argument. So one way to understand it is that productive efforts are burdensome, they're unpleasant, they involve pains, and people undertake these efforts only in the expectation of benefits. So it would be unjust not to let people have the benefits that they've taken pains or labored to get. So space mining companies go to great lengths to extract and retrieve celestial minerals to make them useful for other people here on Earth. And so one might argue that they're entitled to reap the profits of their efforts. Now, there is a germ of truth to this argument. Space mining companies, I think, certainly do acquire a substantial interest in the celestial resources that they work on. But the argument doesn't justify anything like a right to the whole value of the celestial resource. Celestial resources are no one's creation. They exist independently of human activities, and no one has a greater claim on them than anyone else does. It's true that space mining companies do undertake efforts to make those resources useful for people here on Earth, and they're entitled to recoup their investments and their labor. But that argument only yields the conclusion that a company is entitled to the value that it's added to the celestial resource, to compensation for their infrastructural and operational and labor costs, not to the whole market value of the celestial resource itself. So let's think about a third argument, the argument from incentives. Many people argue that justice is best served by allowing improvers to retain the resources they work on because this is a necessary incentive, a spur to socially useful labor. So the idea is that if we let space corporations acquire celestial resources, they're going to do things that will benefit society as a whole. So maybe they're going to aid in decarbonization, they might reduce environmental externalities here on Earth, they might discover new technologies, and the general welfare justifies allowing such acquisition. Now, I think this incentives argument also contains an important germ of truth. The basic idea here is a Humean conventionalist one. The idea is that property rights and celestial resources depend on background social laws and conventions that are regularly followed and perceived as being for the public good. But this raises a further question. Exactly what system of rules would be for the public good? Is it a rule that allows space companies to keep the full value of what they appropriate, or is it some other rule? So we need to compare a unilateral appropriation rule to possible alternative rules in order to be able to say that that unilateral appropriation rule is most socially beneficial. So we might start by considering a law, let's call it Law A, that would allow a space corporation to capture the entire value of a celestial resource. Now, Law A is going to impose a big cost on the people who are excluded by this law. Celestial resources are exhaustible and subtractive, and the appropriation of those resources by some people is going to worsen the situation of others. The law might also foster an unrestrained competition for space resources, which could have negative consequences for international peace. But it might also be that by allowing space corporations to capture these profits, Law A would provide a big spur for social innovation, and that might offer countervailing social benefits in terms of decarbonization, reduced environmental externalities, better access to rare earth minerals, and so on. Now, to know if Law A is justified, then we have to compare it to alternatives. So then we would have to consider another proposal, Law B. Law B, let's say, would allow the space corporation to capture most of the value of a celestial resource, but it would tax space mining at a low rate, with the tax receipts redistributed globally. Now, those who are excluded would pay less cost because they get part of the value of the celestial resource redistributed back to them. So there's a greater gain in social value because they get redistribution, but we have to weigh that against the potential dampening effect that such a tax might have on incentives to enhance decarbonization, create new technologies, and so on. If the dampening effect on incentives of Law B is not too great, then imposing the tax might be more socially beneficial on net than not imposing a tax. And then we have to consider yet other alternatives, Law C, which would impose a higher tax, and Law D, which would impose an even higher one, and so on. So the main point is that to know if a unilateral appropriation rule really is maximally socially beneficial, we've got to compare it to all the other feasible social rules and calculate the net social benefit that each rule would foreseeably produce. And depending on the overall balance of effects, it might turn out that the maximally socially beneficial rule is just not one that allows space companies to unilaterally appropriate the full value of celestial resources. Okay, fourth, let me consider now the idea of basic needs. So many theorists of justice have agreed that if the unilateral annexation of resource rights is to be justified, then one person's annexation of a resource, at the very least, cannot imperil others' ability to meet their basic needs. So we might think of John Locke's enough and is good, we have to leave enough and is good in common for others. A minimalist interpretation of that proviso is that we have to leave enough for others to meet their basic needs. So for example, if a space mining company was to monopolize control of the ice water deposits on the moon and charge exorbitant fees to astronauts from other countries that left them without access to affordable drinking water, then that space company's property rights and those water deposits would not be justified on this idea. So one very widely accepted constraint on individuals and corporations' freedom to annex celestial resources, then, is that they need to ensure that others have access at least to sufficient resources to meet their basic needs. Now, that requirement can still allow for very significant inequalities in resource ownership. So if some U.S. company gets to the moon first and annexes all the ice water, they might have to ensure that astronauts can access it in order to meet their basic needs. But above and beyond that, if they want to sell it for rocket fuel at a really high price or something and make a lot of money, that would be okay, and they could do that. A final set of considerations are considerations of distributive justice. So many theorists argue that authoritative rules about property ought to be designed with distributive justice criteria in mind. Now, there's an extensive literature in political philosophy that debates what the best theory of distributive justice is. I don't want to review that here. But many theorists do agree that even if everybody has enough to meet their basic needs, a distribution can still be unjust because some people are much better off under that distribution than others for reasons that can't be justified. Now, one very widely endorsed distributive principle is the priority principle, which states that in distributing resources, we should give more weight to the interests of people who are already worse off in absolute terms. So gains to the less well-off matter a lot more morally than gains to the already quite wealthy and well provided for. Now, this priority view thinks that some inequalities can be unacceptable. Where the inequalities benefit people who are less well off. For example, by providing incentives to do socially productive things, then those inequalities might be justified. John Rawls's well-known difference principle is one version of this. He has a principle that gives absolute priority to the worst off. So he says that inequalities are justifiable only if they're to the greatest benefit of the least advantaged people in society. And that priority view, I think, provides a good justification for some elements of the Moon Agreement, especially the provision requiring that the benefits of resource exploitation in space be redistributed with special reference to the interests of poor or non-spacefaring countries. Another very widely endorsed set of distributive considerations are relational in character. So even if inequalities in income and wealth are not necessarily objectionable in themselves, many people think they can become objectionable sometimes if they lead to objectionable social relations. So sometimes the wealthy can leverage their advantages to dominate or exploit those who are poor. Or they start to form a favored social class with higher public status than everybody else. And many people argue that inequality, even if some inequality is okay, inequalities can become objectionable when they lead to these kinds of objectionable social relations. And one concern from this point of view are the global inequalities between countries that space mining may exacerbate. So many developing countries lack the technology to engage in space mining, and some have mining-dependent economies that will foreseeably be devastated by the advent of these new space industries. So one way to transform unequal status relations and to prevent domination and exploitation is to distribute money or other goods to those who are vulnerable to domination or who have lower status. Those resources can safeguard them against relationships of dependence and can enhance their status. And under some conditions, these kind of relational concerns might justify further redistribution beyond what the priority principle would support. So inequalities that would subject some peoples to domination or exploitation or threaten their status as full equal participants in global society might require further equalization of holdings. And we might think of technology transfer or a stake for poor countries and mining corporations as one way of engaging those concerns. All right, so if we sum up all these considerations together, then I think a normatively justified regime of property and celestial resources will allow space mining companies to profit from their activities, to recoup their investment and labor costs, and it will provide an incentive for socially beneficial innovation. But it should not extend these companies full ownership of whatever celestial resources they grab. Rather, the sale of celestial resources should be taxed at a level that maximizes the net social benefit of space mining for the globally least well-off. And care should also be taken to ensure that space mining does not create international domination or exacerbate social stratification among peoples. And one way to do that may be to subsidize the transfer of space mining technology for the benefit of less developed peoples, or to include them in international space mining ventures. So I then turn to further normative criteria that bear on the design of space governance institutions. And here I'm going to go quickly over this bit because I'm running out of time. But I suggest that the appropriation of celestial resources needs to proceed in accordance with the international rule of law. So there is a lot of vagueness about the criteria that a justified appropriation needs to meet. And we can expect that states and companies, even when they're trying to act on their own best understanding of a justified property regime and celestial resources, they're going to disagree about those criteria, about when one gains rights over an object, and what the duties associated with those rights might be. So there is a need for international legislation to offer clear resolutions to those disagreements and a clear set of rules that make it apparent when one has gained a property right over a celestial resource. And for that reason, I think it's not acceptable for countries to just pass national level legislation to legalize appropriation of celestial resources and to proceed on their own national understanding of what justified property regime would look like, given the possibility for conflict and even war over these matters. A second governance criteria, I think, is an environmental stewardship criterion. I think a justified governance regime is also going to have to guard against potential negative environmental impacts of space mining, the proliferation of space junk in orbit, the possibility of introducing unknown biohazards into the Earth's environment, and also the possibility of undermining efforts at decarbonization here on Earth. So another normative desideratum for space governance is that international oversight be put in place to ensure that space mining is environmentally responsible. And finally, I think that there are claims to political inclusion and participation in the legislation of celestial property rules. So I think it would be wrong for one powerful state or group of states, like the US perhaps in the Artemis Accord, to just unilaterally lay down its preferred scheme of space rules and to twist the arms of all other countries into adopting those rules. I think a better method would be that for all peoples in society acting together to have input into those rules. So for that reason, I think that legitimate space governance institutions should provide some forum for representing the world's peoples in the legislation of celestial property law. Now, putting both the property and the governance criteria together, I think that the Moon Agreement scores pretty high according to those normative desiderata. The main concern about the Moon Agreement is not its normative attractiveness, it's its feasibility. It's been ratified by only 18 countries. So while the Moon Agreement would be normatively desirable, it may not be presently workable. And that raises the question of whether there's a second best celestial governance regime that we should support instead. And here I want to say that when we think about other regimes, we should think about how those second best options might evolve over time. So how likely is a second best space governance framework to facilitate a gradual evolution towards a more just and legitimate regime over time? And here I think that in the medium term, maybe the best option is to attempt a new but less ambitious space resource extraction treaty. And that agreement would aim to fulfill some but not all of the normative desiderata that I just outlined today and that are in the Moon Agreement. So for example, to secure the assent of the US and other spacefaring powers, it might commit to only a very weak interpretation of the common benefit idea. Say, taxing space mining at a modest level to ensure that basic needs are met, but eschewing larger ambitions at equitable sharing of the benefits from space resource exploitation. The agreement might also establish a procedure for revisiting and updating celestial property rules over time as commercial space exploitation evolves, maybe with the agreement of a qualified majority of spacefaring and non-spacefaring nations. And further, that new multilateral framework might embrace weak, but not trivial, environmental stewardship standards, like a commitment to dispose of space debris and to submit to a common regime to reduce biohazards. And finally, it might establish an international governance authority that could oversee space mining in a fairly minimal way by issuing extraction licenses, by deconflicting operations, and by collecting this de minimis tax. But beyond that, space mining companies would be free to acquire ownership in the minerals they exploit and to profit from their sale. Now, that kind of regime falls far short of satisfying the normative criteria that I just laid out. But I think that there might be reason to support it nonetheless, because it might provide a workable basis for moving towards justified space governance in the future by gradual steps. So that modest framework would ensure the international rule of law and ensure that all states were included in legislating celestial property rules, even if at a fairly low baseline. It would enshrine some minimal principles of distributive justice, the basic needs idea, and environmental stewardship, and it would set the precedent that those principles are relevant and that they could evolve further in the future legally. And third, by creating an international space resource authority with minimal powers, it would allow for some international regulation and oversight of space activities. And this provides a basis for a more robust regime to emerge with time. So I think that some more modest schemes that secure a kind of lowest common denominator baseline on de minimis versions of these core principles might provide a feasible path forward that could be worth exploring. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.